All right, good morning. All right, we are at the tail end of Genesis 11, and my goal today is to get all the way through Genesis chapter 14. We'll see if that happens. I mentioned that from this point on, we're going to be moving more quickly. And remember, I'm not trying to teach every single verse in Genesis. We're trying to give you tools to help you interpret the book and for you to study it on your own. And we now focus on the man Abraham. And we read about him, we're introduced to him at the end of chapter 11. So you might want to have an open Bible. And I would just, by the way, just recommend if you want to get the most out of what we're going to do here on out, just think about before you come, read through a couple of the next chapters, and you'll have a good idea of the content of the chapters. So even just, if we were just to read through Genesis 11 and 12, or the end of 11, 12, 13, 14, you know, that's going to take a third of our time right there. So I would encourage you to read through that. And if you know the book of Genesis fairly well, you'll be reminded of the accounts and the stories that are mentioned here. But we do get a shift again in Genesis 11, 27, where we have this phrase. This is the genealogy of Terah. Terah is the father of Abram, we learn in that verse in Genesis 11, 27. So what that means is that Genesis 11, 27 begins a new section. And here we use that word again that we've used, the toledot. That's that word that's translated as this is the genealogy, or sometimes this is the history of. And so we have a new section here. We also learn, as he will become very important. This is, by the way, page 38 of your notes. We also learn that where Lot, who is related to Abraham, Abraham's nephew, came from, as he will become very significant in Abram's life and also the life of the people of Israel. I should mention one thing, by the way, from here on out. I'm going to try to use, in order of the scripture, Abram's name until his name is changed to Abraham. But if I mess up, please don't throw stones, all right? So his name is changed later in the book, but he's introduced to us as Abram. Also, this is just a point to note here. Remember that the chapter divisions, you know, chapter 11, 12, 13, 14, they are not inspired scripture, okay? So those are added much later to help us find things in the Bible quickly. So if I was redoing the chapter divisions, I would actually move chapter 12 to start up at where 11:27 is, because that is actually the natural breaking point in the account, because you have another, this is the genealogy of, or this is the history of, the toledot is the Hebrew word there. So the chapter numbers and also the verse divisions are added by added much later, and largely they're very good, but occasionally it's like, if I was redoing it, I would change it. But at this point, they're not going to change, because we have about 400 years, 500 years of history with that, and every major Bible version uses it. So we're just going to stick with it for probably until the Lord comes. That's probably what will happen at this point. All right. So we have a new section that begins, and we are introduced to the genealogy of Terah, the father of Abram. His passage also opens the curtain on a new period in God's plan, and that of the creation of the nation of Israel through the call of Abram. And unlike Noah, who we see from Noah some measure of faithfulness in him, although certainly God's grace, Abram is not noticed or chosen because of a particular quality. In other words, there's nothing that we see in the text where it's like, you know, and this guy stands out among everybody else. In fact, I think if we actually study the whole of the biblical revelation, we find out that Abram was a nobody who did not know God, did not worship God, and God in his grace just simply called him. Now, if you read the end of Genesis 11 into chapter 12, we might get the impression that God spoke to Abram after the death of his father, Terah. So if you look down at verse number 31, it says, "And Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and they went out from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan. And Then they came to Haran and dwelt there. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. And then it says in chapter 12, now the Lord had said to Abram, and depending on how your translation reads, you might get the impression that it's after Terah dies that the Lord speaks. But actually, the grammar of this would indicate that it was probably already God had spoken to Abram, saying, get out of your country, get out of your homeland. And we also know that because it's very clear both in Genesis 15:7 and also in Acts 7 when Stephen preaches his sermon right before he is stoned. Both of those texts say that actually it was while Abram was in Ur of the Chaldees that God spoke to him. So so this, when you have kind of a summary of Terah's life in verses 27 through 31, and then you have in chapter 12 something that occurs in the middle of Terah's life. It's earlier when God speaks to Abram. Now, Ur of the Chaldeans, if you want to know a little bit about that, I've got this in your notes, was an area of Mesopotamia that was well known for its worship of the moon. Well known for its worship of the moon. In fact, the name Sarai, that's Abram's wife, is the Hebrew equivalent to the name of the wife of the moon god that was known in Ur. In Ur, there was a large ziggurat, and if you want to know what that is, that's essentially like a large pyramid-like structure that was used as a sort of temple. If you think about, what is it, the Mayans in, what's that? Aztecs, thank you. Mayans might have done it too, right? It was all over the world. You find these kinds of ziggurat, these pyramid-like structures that were used in various cultic ritualistic practices. And they were great icons of a society and a civilization, but they also were tied to religion. Well, in Ur, there was one of these that was used likely as a way to climb and view the heavens and worship the god of the moon. And according to Joshua 24:2, Abram was a worshiper of those false gods. In fact, so Joshua, remember, you get the chronology here. You get Abraham, you know, roughly, I'm just rounding off numbers here, a little before 2000 BC. And then you've got Isaac, then you got Jacob, Joseph, then the people of Abraham, of Israel. They move into Egypt. They spend 400 years there. They leave, go through the Exodus wilderness wanderings. Joshua leads the people into Israel. And at the end of his life, he recounts how God had worked through a time for the people of Israel. And one of the things he mentions is that our forefather Abraham, who kind of started this whole thing, he was a worshiper of false gods. He was not a worshiper of the one true God of heaven. So the scripture is very clear about that Abraham worshipped these kinds of false gods before God called him. We would rightly call him a pagan. And yet, out of the blue, God in his sovereign grace spoke to Abraham. There, I messed it up in the notes and I just messed it up here as well. Abram, he spoke to Abram, all right? Now, we're not told why he was chosen. There's no evidence that Abram was any better than any of his family. In fact, when Nehemiah, much later yet in the history of the people of Israel, recounts the events of what led them to that place in the post-exilic world, that's after the exile of Babylon, Nehemiah just simply states that God chose him. And that, by the way, fits the theme of Genesis, that God is the hero of the narrative. He's the hero of the narrative. He's the one who is orchestrating all of these things. Now, that idea of God being hero becomes even more evident when you look at the covenant that God makes with Abram. And we see that in Genesis 12, 1 through 3. And this is worth reading. I mean, all of the scripture is worth reading, but this is important. Now, the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abraham's call was in the form of an order composed of two parts, one negative, the other positive. The negative part here is a total separation from, number one, his country, And more specifically, number two, his homeland. And then this is also significant, also from his father's house. And we're going to see that Abram doesn't actually do that right away. He takes some time. Okay, and in fact, one of the themes that we're going to continually see in the patriarchs, and we use that term patriarch, we're thinking about in this context, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the 12 sons of Jacob, is that we're going to see that there's actually a good deal of unfaithfulness towards God in their lives, and yet God continually blesses them because of his covenant promises. So we'll see that here even yet this morning, that Abram doesn't doesn't fully separate from his father's house like he's called to do. Now, the positive part of this was a journey to a new country which was unfamiliar, but which the Lord had promised to show him. Now, furthermore, in these verses, God gives Abram a unilateral or unconditional covenant. And here we should be on the notes for today, I think, page 39. All right. He gives a unilateral or unconditional covenant. We talked about these covenants a few weeks ago when we were looking at the covenant that God makes with Noah after the flood. And remember that we distinguish between two types of covenants. There are unilateral covenants. They're often also called royal grant covenants. These are where a stronger, more powerful person simply blesses or gives a lesser individual or nation or people. Okay, that's this kind. The other kind of covenant is a bilateral, where it's two parties who are coming to an agreement. I'll do this and you'll do that. Now, Bible teachers will often call what Abram experiences here, instead of the word unilateral, they'll use the word unconditional covenant. I don't love the word unconditional here. Don't love the word unconditional. I'm not against it. And the reason for that is because when you read through the covenant that God makes with Abram, it's kind of anticipated here. Yes, actually, I left my tea sitting right over there by the sound booth. That would be great. It's in a mug someplace there. I think it's on that little shelf. If you read through these kind of unilateral covenants, they often do have stipulations with them. It's like, okay, here's what I'm going to do for you, and you're going to, as part, this is what you're going to do as part of this, but I'm just dictating it to you, right? And you'll actually see that with Abram, as even in this text, you're going to leave your country, your homeland, and your father's house. That's what you're going to do. Okay. So unconditional can get a little bit fuzzy. But the key is that these unilateral covenants are blessings upon the person. The royal grant was often given as a king would give this kind of covenant to reward just goodness and faithfulness and delight in the person that they're seeking to bless. And that's the kind of covenant that Abraham experiences. Now, this covenant offered several provisions or blessings. Number one, Abram would become a great nation. And it's actually interesting that the irony of this is pretty thick, because Sarai has no child. So if you think about the order of this, and our chapter division here might cloud this, we're told in Genesis 11:30, Sarah was barren and she had no child. And somewhere, you know, before Terah dies, God had said to Abraham, guess what? You're gonna have a great nation. And the text is emphasizing that doesn't seem possible at this point. So that's a challenge for him. It also promises that God would bless him, which would also be very difficult for Abram to grasp, because usually in the context of the ancient Near East, that's the region he comes from, blessing is tied to your family, right? You know, you're tied to your immediate family, your clan, your tribe, your people. And that's where blessing was at. And here God's saying to him, you're going to be blessed. Get away from your family. All right. Some of you might say, well, I wouldn't mind that some days. All right. But not in this day. This is a significant deal. to leave your homeland like this. Furthermore, Abram's name would be great. God bestows a royal title upon Abraham, which becomes significant as kings are promised from Abram and Sarai in Genesis 17:6 and 16. Furthermore, Abram is identified as a prince by the Hittites in Genesis 23:6. Like that greatness is almost like a kingly type role. It's a great figure. Abram is also said that he would be a source of blessing. In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. All the nations of the earth will be blessed. Number five, Abram would be protected by God, who promised to bless those who blessed him and curse those who cursed him. I should read him instead of his there. Now, this covenant is absolutely foundational, being the basis of later covenants and of the prophetic program of God. And this is referenced in the New Testament as a source of God's grace and provision and ultimately God's justifying work. And we are blessed in the Abrahamic covenant, as we will see a little bit later. Now, note the differences between some of the major biblical covenants from Abraham on. The Abrahamic covenant, that's typically the way that it is used here, you'll see in Bible literature. The Abrahamic covenant is unilateral, and it's a royal grant from God. We see in the life of Abraham that it is promised in Genesis 12. It is cut in Genesis 15, and when we get there, we'll talk about what that means. There, Abraham is promised a specific portion of land, and it is renewed in Genesis 17, 1 through 8. There are benefits to the covenant that are listed above. We just went through those. But there are also other elements that surround it. There's a sacrifice in Genesis 15, and there's a token given as a sign of the covenant in Genesis 17. And that token, by the way, is the sign of circumcision. So there's the Abrahamic covenant. As you read through the Bible and you get into the Pentateuch, still written by Moses, we also come to the Mosaic covenant. And I'm looking at the most significant covenants here in the Bible at this point. This is the covenant that was made between God and the people of Israel after they left the land of Egypt. This covenant was different than Abraham's covenant. It is a bilateral covenant or a conditional covenant. It is of the vassal kind of covenant. This is in the ancient Near East. This would involve a powerful king coming to somebody else or two equal parties and saying, all right, we're going to come to terms. You're going to do this. I'm going to do that. We're going to come to an agreement. Just like the covenant with Abraham, the Mosaic covenant is displayed in three distinct places. You will find it was promised in Exodus 19. That's where Moses goes up on Mount Sinai to receive the covenant. But it is not cut until you get to Exodus 24. There, the people swear an oath. Moses reads the covenant, and the people say, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. That's when the covenant is enacted. And finally, the covenant is renewed with the people of Israel in Deuteronomy 29. There are benefits to this bilateral covenant. Blessings are offered in Deuteronomy 28. But there are also curses in Deuteronomy 28. In fact, there's a lot of them. And that, by the way, is the key distinction between the unilateral and the bilateral covenant. The bilateral covenant says, you do this, and I'll do this. If you don't do this, I'm going to do this to you. All right. But in the unilateral covenant, the one that is made here with Abram, or at least promised here in Genesis 12, it's formally adopted and cut in Genesis 15. That covenant is, guess what, Abram? I'm going to do all these things for you. Bless, 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 bless. So the Mosaic covenant is very different than the covenant made with Abram here. Finally, another important covenant is the Davidic covenant. We're going to discover that more in 2 Samuel chapter 7. In fact, I probably should have put the reference to that in your notes. The Davidic covenant is for the people of Israel. It is promised that Christ, the Messiah, will be king formally one day. His throne will be established. I did have it in your notes, didn't I? I was skipping down further. There we go. I'm skipping down. There we go. The covenant is outlined in 2 Samuel 7. This is also a unilateral royal grant covenant. God gave certain promises to David, a great name, land, a dynasty, a descendant, and eternal kingship. Now, what is the relationship between the church, of the church to these covenants? How do we relate to them? With the Abrahamic covenant, we are in its broad provisions. Through Abraham, the nations of the earth would be blessed. And that includes us today, especially as it relates to Christ, who is the seed of the covenant promise. Now, that's a whole other topic in and of itself that you need to read through the book of Galatians, but also Romans 4 and 5 to really get the full scope of that. But here's what that means, is that the promises made to Abram in Genesis 12, the covenant that was cut in Genesis 15 and renewed in Genesis 17, do have direct impact on us today. Insofar as we have been united to Christ by faith, we are heirs of these covenant promises. And we have certain blessings that are applied to us. The Mosaic covenant, that's very different. The church is not under this covenant at all. We are not under the Mosaic covenant. It is made obsolete in two ways. First, Christ actually fulfilled it. And second, the people of Israel did not obey it. In fact, I would suggest if you read through the book of Hebrews, it becomes very apparent that the old covenant is fading away and was about to be gone. Now, this does not mean, however, that the old covenant has nothing to say to us, insofar as it reveals the character of God and what God expects people to be like. It has application to us today. So the Mosaic covenant, that's basically halfway through Exodus through the end of Deuteronomy, that's all tied into that in various ways. So we've been reading through the book of Leviticus on our Sunday night song, Scriptures and Snacks. And the last night that we read, somebody said to me, "When are you going to preach Leviticus?" Well, I actually would hope to someday. That's going to be very challenging because you don't preach Leviticus verse by verse by verse unless you want to just absolutely, you know, empty this church out fast, all right? That would get very, very tiring. But there are broad themes that indicate what God expects of people, how he atones for sin. God's righteousness is displayed. I would be very comfortable preaching through Leviticus and finding much rich application for our lives today, including in some of the commands of God. But we're not under the covenant in the same sense in which we are obligated to obey all of its commands. Christ fulfilled it. It's obsolete. Finally, we have the Davidic covenant. The Davidic covenant. The Davidic covenant, as I mentioned, is for the people of Israel. We, in some sense, do have blessings with this. If you believe, like we do here, that there is going to be a future kingdom of Christ in which Jesus reigns in Jerusalem on the Davidic throne and that the people of Israel are gathered there, we also will be with that Christ ruling and reigning. There is distinction between Israel and the church in the future, but the blessings of the Davidic covenant will be in some sense ours as we rule with Christ over the nations. But formally, it is for the people of Israel. And we have hope in that because we long to rule and reign with Christ one day. Let's talk about Abram's obedience. We do see that Abram seems to leave without hesitation. And so, you know, you get the sense there in Genesis 12, verse 4. So Abram departed. Not get the sense. It says, as the Lord had spoken to him. But then we read this next line. But Lot went with him. You might have never noticed that before. Did Abram actually fulfill what God said to him at this point? The answer is no. And furthermore, if you go back to the end of chapter 11, we know that at least for part of this journey, he took his father, Terah, with him as well. So we do see some hesitation. In fact, it's interesting. I think Moses intentionally puts this both before God's unilateral promise that's given to him and after. You see in both instances that God is choosing to bless Abram even if Abram doesn't fulfill his end of the bargain. And this is, by the way, a beautiful picture of God's gracious favor towards those whom he set his love upon. So this makes the conditions, their letter A, to God's command incomplete until Lot would separate from Abram. Lot was Abram's heir at this point for all practical purposes. I just put this note in here in general. We read about this terebinth tree. It's also translated as the oak of Morah in verse number 6. This apparently was a very significant place for the people of that day and also later in the history of the people of Israel. It only appears in the singular here, but it also in the plural form appears in Deuteronomy 11:30. And I think it's also likely what is referenced in Genesis 35 and also Joshua 24. There may even be evidence of that in the book of Judges as well, of this location being significant. And you can do your own study on that, but it may well be that this was a place in which God often spoke to his people. But there is some shroud of mystery surrounding that as well. But people wonder that. So it's translated in some translation as oak, others terebinth. It's challenging to know exactly how to translate that. We are dealing with literature that is well over 3,000 years old here. The mention of the Canaanites in verse 6 is also significant. It says there, so Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him. Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old. Down to verse 6. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem as far as the terebinth tree of Morah, and the Canaanites were there in the land. The mention of the Canaanites in verse 6 ties back to the passage to the Table of Nations in chapter 10. Remember, we learned about that Canaan was cursed. But it also looks forward to Abram's interaction with the Canaanites. But in addition, it looks forward to the people of Israel's interaction with them as they are receiving this shortly before they crossed into the land of promise and shortly before, as Moses gives them the Pentateuch just before they cross into that land. So there's some thematic elements that are tying in the whole of Genesis there. Well, Abram is called out of his country. He arrives in Canaan, and he doesn't stay there very long. And so here we find Abram in Egypt. And this is the account where he goes down to Egypt, and I remember this. You remember your Sunday school lesson. You read through the Bible, Sunday school of old. You read through the Bible. Remember that Abram, there's a famine in the land, and he goes down to Egypt, and he, you know, on the way, he says to his wife, essentially, "We're going to lie about you being my wife. We're going to say that you're my sister," and he was related to her if you follow the family tree. And so, she's my sister. And Pharaoh takes Sarai into his household, presumably to make her part of his harem. And plagues come on the Pharaoh. Pharaoh confronts Abram about what's going on here. And Abram says, "You know, I was scared." And Pharaoh says, "Get out of here," and he sends him full of wealth and prosperity. This is not a good scene for Abram, and it's not a good start to his journey of faith. In fact, we see faithlessness here. In fact, Abraham shows doubts in the promises of God in two ways in this account, at least two. First of all, Abram intended to dwell or sojourn in Egypt. You see that in verse number 10. Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there. Some of your translations will say sojourn. I think if you have an ESV, I'm not sure what a New American Standard does with that. Sojourn is a word there. For those of you who remember that I did this thing on the Bible and immigration a while back, you might remember that there's different words used in the Bible for the status of immigrants in the Mosaic Covenant and in the first five books of the Pentateuch. And this is that word gar, which means resident alien. Okay? So what that indicates is that Abram intended to stay in Egypt for a long period of time. He wasn't just going there as a short-term refugee. He was establishing some measure of residence there. Now let's just think about what God had told him. Is this good or bad? This is very much bad. This is not good. And furthermore, we see that Abram also doubts the promises of God. He lied, number two, Abram lied about his wife Sarai in order to protect himself. So Sarah was, in fact, his half-sister, but half-truth is still a full lie. Remember that God had said, I will bless you. You're going to have a great nation. It's going to come from you. Those who curse you will be cursed. And so Abram promptly just ignores that. And by the way, I think there's much to be learned in his bad example about how we are not much different often than Abram. So God is still gracious to his people. Some have asked this question, was it wrong for Abram to go out of the land? Although the text does not say that Abram sinned in fleeing to Egypt, each time the patriarchs of Genesis leave the land of promise, the results are not good. They're not good. And you can see the references there. You might argue that it was a good thing that Joseph was, you know, when he went to Egypt and Jacob led his family down there, that they were spared from the famine. But of course, the result is that they were enslaved. I think even though God providentially works things for good, and this is kind of a foreshadowing of that later Exodus event, even though God works things for good, even when people make bad choices, the text does seem to be indicating that Israel, the people of Israel, needs to be in her land. That's where God intended them for them to be. Now, in spite of the failure, God fulfilled his covenant promises by protecting and blessing him. In fact, he leaves Egypt a wealthy man. It's also, as I mentioned this just a moment ago, the plagues brought upon Pharaoh and his household foreshadow the plagues of Exodus. And remember, this would have been significant. The people of Israel have just left the land of Egypt. Moses is giving them the Pentateuch. He's about to die. They're going to cross over into the promised land, and they're going to go to the land of Canaan. Would God bless his people? Well, they could look back and say, you know what? Our forefather Abram, he went through a time of great sorrow when he left the land of promise, just like we did. But God protected him by sending plagues to the Pharaoh, and God blessed him. And if God did that to him, he can do that to us as well. So there's hope that's given here for the people of Israel. And even in failure, God gives hope. That was also significant for the people, would have been significant for the people of Israel, because they had failed. They did not believe God when they were called out of Egypt. Remember, they wanted to go back multiple times. They won't go into the promised land. There's giants there. We're not touching that. And yet God still fulfilled his promises. So they also could have hope. Furthermore, God's protection of Abram here included protecting his elect line. Had Pharaoh been allowed to take Sarai as his wife, including having sexual relations with her, Isaac could have been thought to have been Pharaoh's son and not Abram's. So this was significant that God protected that. By the way, we're going to see the same kind of thing when we get to Isaac as well. Same thing is going to happen there. Having said that all, though, Abram's sin did bring consequences. You see that he lost his reputation and his testimony. Pharaoh does not think very well of him. Hagar was also probably, and note that word probably acquired during this stay because she was Egyptian. You can read about that in Genesis 16:1 and Genesis 16:3. I think it also says that in like Genesis 24, something like that. I'd have to look it up. But it does say that specifically, that she was an Egyptian. So likely she was brought into the household during this time. And of course, that's going to become a major problem for Abram and his descendants. We'll see that when we get to the whole, let's get a son through Hagar episode. Furthermore, Abram had taken Lot with him to Egypt, and he was apparently seduced. So if you go forward to Genesis 13:10, this is where they're going to pick where they're going to stay. Genesis 13 and verse 10 says, "And Lot lifted his eyes and saw the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, the land of Egypt, as you go down to Zoar." So Lot liked what he saw in Egypt, and he picks poorly and eventually pitched his tent towards Sodom, which brought about great destruction in his family's life. So there were consequences to Abram's actions. God still blesses, but there were consequences. And I think those are good lessons for us today. Good lessons. We're not that different than Abram. At least I'm not, all right? Okay, I'm right there. All right, number three, Abram separates from Lot. Now, Moses still, in spite of Abram, chapter 12, the first part is wonderful, but everything that surrounds it is not good for Abram. But God and Moses here, through God through Moses, emphasizes God's blessing upon Abram as a fulfillment of God's covenant in verse 2 when he speaks of his great wealth. And that really is stunning in chapter 3 in verse 2. Abram was very rich in livestock, silver, and gold. And so in spite even of his failures, God, because of his covenant promises, was faithful. Abram, in some sense, in chapter 13, is given a new beginning and returning back to the land. I think also we see that Abram evidences some repentance as he calls upon the name of the Lord. And I might be reading too much into this, but I'm not the only one who've noticed this. But you just don't see in chapter 12 Abram calling out to God. You see him making bad decision after bad decision. But in chapter 13, you have him just clearly trusting in the Lord. So there's some sense of repentance, I think, here. Abram's renewed faith in God is evident in this passage. It's evident as he offers Lot the first choice of the land. Now, that's amazing because Abram's the older guy here. You know, he's the uncle. He's got the. He should have dibs. It's God who said, I'm going to show you this land. And it's Abram that brought Lot with him. This should be Abram's choice. But Abram really trusts the Lord here. I think Abram knew that God had promised his offspring this land anyways. And further, after he separated from Lot and settled again, he builds another altar to the Lord. So we just see his devotion to God. Sadly, though, we see that Lot and Abram act in opposite ways. Lot, when you look at this account, we notice it just a little bit more. He looks out and he sees only the physical here. So he looked for what would immediately prosper him, even when it involves settling near Sodom. And if you read through chapter 13, you have this just disturbing thing that Lot, you know, he goes in the plains near Sodom, and eventually there's this progression throughout Genesis where he's getting closer to Sodom, and then he's actually living inside the city. And I imagine that there was great prosperity there, but he sold his soul for it. Probably better stated, he kept his soul, but he sold his family's soul because nothing good happens at the end of it. Abram, on the other hand, believed that God would provide for him and eventually give the whole of the land to his offspring. I think we see the great faith of Abram. And it's possible that the chastening hand of the Lord was upon Abram and he recognized the error of his ways. We also learn that Abram settles, letter E, in Hebron. That proves to be significant in Abram's life. This is the place that even the Canaanites first recognize that Abram had some claim on the land. You can read about that in Genesis 23. Oh, I said I was going to get through chapter 14, but that's not going to happen. So we need to stop, all right? We'll resume next week in chapter number 14 and keep pushing our way through the book of Genesis together. I'm out of time, so thank you so much. You are dismissed.